All right. Hey, everybody. I want to thank you for joining us today for Bible News Radio. Today, I have a special guest on our show because, recently I became aware of some books that were written by this guy because I happen to know his wife, Sally Kern. You might have heard of her. She's created a lot of problems in Oklahoma for the gay activist community. They don't like her very much. But, you know, that was past history, and and she's a godly lady. I love her and really respect what she has done. But her husband, Dr. Steve Kern, actually pastored for like 40 years, which, you know, tells you that he's got faith, because, you know, that's a long time to be a pastor. And as you guys know, I have a lot of pastors on our show. I don't know, Bible News Radio is the place pastors go to die, I guess. You know, they come here as a last resort. That was a joke. Just kidding. But, you know, the thing is today we're going to talk to him about his book. Let me show you it. It's called No Other Gods, the Biblical Creation Worldview. And when I learned about this, I thought, ooh, this is so great, because he's a six-day literalist like me. And I mean, because seriously, if you read the Bible, you need to take it literally, except in the few places it's not supposed to be taken literally. So I thought, you know what, I should have him come on and talk about it. Because one of the things that we do here is we want to be able to equip you with biblical knowledge that's appropriate for today, so that you can feel confident in your faith. And frankly, you know, I know a lot of you are women and you're like, whatever, I'm just trying to raise my grandkids and my children. I don't really care about this stuff. Problem is, you have to care about it, because your kids are being taught garbage in school. And yes, even some Christian schools, believe me, I can tell you stories about that. But the more you know what you believe and why you believe it, the more confident you're going to be in the marketplace of ideas. So that's why I have Dr. Kern on the show. I'm going to call him Brother Kern, because he's my
brother.
Bro.
Steve, whatever.
Steve. Anyway, so welcome to the show. Hey, I'm glad that you're here. And you know, I am truly honored that you're here. I mean, I think it's so cool. I've heard about you from Sally, but, you know, I mean, you had to stand behind her when she went through all her stuff.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to be on and just have a good time of fellowship with you. Talk about some of the stuff the Lord's been doing.
Yeah. So, okay. So you're a pastor. So I want to back up and ask you a few questions.
Okay.
Okay. So how did you come to faith in Christ? That's one first question.
Well, I grew up in church. Interesting. When I was 3 months old, my birth father deserted my mother and me and my four sisters. And so she was a single mom for about 3 years. And then she married a man named George Kern, who my birth father apparently was an alcoholic, but he left and I never saw him again. But anyway, when she married George Kern, he took us to church. And so I grew up in small churches. My parents really, mother played the piano and he led the music. And so when I was 9 years old, I knew I needed Jesus. So I went forward and asked Jesus into my heart. And then later on, I went through an experience when I was 11 years old. I was shot with a 22 pistol five times. And that kind of got my attention about, you know, life. And so I really, there was a revival that took place with Freddie Gage at Central Baptist Church in Phoenix, Arizona. And it was at that point in time that I realized that I was a sinner, and that's why I needed the Savior. And so it's kind of like the Lord was getting me ready when I was 9, but I solidified it when I was 12. And so I gave my heart to Jesus there in that revival and began my walk with the Lord as a 12-year-old kid.
Wow. Oh, yeah. And by the way, everybody, today's his birthday. So we won't say how old you are, though.
Okay, that's fine.
But he's old people, just so you know. Just kidding.
That's probably obvious just by
Well, okay, you pastored for 40 years. I'm sorry, I shouldn't be teasing you on your birthday. But I will say that, okay, so you were basically adopted by
George Kern.
By George Kern. And and then you got shot. What happened? You were shot? Why'd somebody shoot you? Was that an accident?
Well, I was 11. My youngest sister had a boyfriend. He was 17. And he took me hunting. Okay. And he had this pistol that we went and did some target shooting, and it was malfunctioning. And so he decided he was going to fix it. So we sat down on the back porch of his car, of his house there in Phoenix. And I'm just sitting there looking around where he lived. I've not been there before. And the next thing I knew, I felt this electricity go through me while I heard this gun go off. And what happened basically was this malfunctioning .22 pistol. It wasn't a pistol, actually. It went off, and I was sitting right next to him, and three of the bullets went through my back. One just missed my spine by just a fraction of an inch, and then two went through my arm. But
wow.
Anyway, I was the miracle kid of Phoenix there for a while.
Wow.
And the interesting thing is that my dad was a music director at Central Baptist Church at that time. And there that particular day, it was a Labor Day. And that's why we weren't in school. Oh. And the Baptist men's were having a conference there. And R.G. Lee was the speaker. And so the word came to my dad there while he was at the conference. And so they stopped the whole conference, and R.G. Lee got up and prayed for me.
Oh.
And so that was kind of a special thing in my life, to know that R.G. Lee and a couple of thousand preachers prayed for this 12-year-old kid or 11-year-old kid.
Hmm. Wow. So that's amazing. Okay. See, everybody, you never know what people go through, so you shouldn't be judging them, which I've learned. But okay. So you became a Christian then, because you realize you're a sinner, which is a good thing. Mm-hmm. And then how did you know you were called to be a pastor?
Well, that is a long story. I wasn't called to be a pastor until I was 28. Of course, I grew up in church and all of that, but never really felt called a pastor. My parents actually, when I graduated from high school, a week after I graduated from high school, my dad announced to me and my sister, one of my sisters and mother, that he was going to divorce my mother and marry another woman. Well, I was a 17-year-old kid at that time, and that was quite a shock. But the Lord really gave me grace in that circumstance. And my mother she handled it very well. But I had to make a decision. As a 17-year-old kid who'd grown up in church and was trying to live for Jesus, not doing a very good job of it, but I had to make a decision. Is this faith that I have, because my parents made me go to church and all that kind of thing, but was this my faith, or was this just me doing what they wanted me to do, as their son? Well, it became my conviction that this was my faith. And my parents, they had to be responsible for their actions and choices, and I have to be responsible for mine. And so God gave me the grace to forgive and go on with my life. But right then, it all kind of, at the time, Vietnam and all, and I tried to go to college for a year and flunked out, and was going to get drafted. So I joined the Marine Corps. I was in the Marines for 4 years and spent 18 months in Vietnam. And while I was in Vietnam, I was a cook. I had a burner blow up in my face and catch my head on fire. And so I spent a couple of months in the hospital ship there, but I really learned a lot about war and that experience. But and the Lord was dealing with me even then. And then right after that, I had a girlfriend that sent me a Dear John letter while I was there in the Marine Corps, and I thought my life was over, you know. And so right after I got out of the Marine Corps, about a week later, I met this really good looking college lady named Sally Rogers. And Sally was a Sunday school teacher, and I was teaching Sunday school class that time. And we hit it off in about 6 months. We were married, and we went to this church. We prayed a prayer when we got married. Lord, don't send us to a church where we get busy. Send us a church where we can grow. So the Lord sent us this church, MacArthur Boulevard, there in Irving, Texas. And it was during the Jesus movement. And there was a mighty moving of the Lord's Spirit there at that church. And the Lord began to move, and there was an organization that was started there called True Vine Ministry. And it was ministry to street kids who were getting saved during the Jesus movement there. And the churches didn't know what to do with them. So they started this True Vine Ministry where we ministered to those kids coming off the street. And so I started teaching some in some Bible studies and leading some worship service. I learned how to play the guitar and Vietnam. But anyway, so I'm making this long, but anyway, while I was in the ministry there. Now, the thing about that ministry was, in order to be in that ministry, you had to sell everything, and you had to go totally and completely full faith, quit your jobs and everything. And we did that. We joined that ministry and, believing God for all of our needs. And we were in it for about 2 years, and God met every need that we had during that time. But it was in that process that I was sitting in church there at a church where we were ministering. And I just happened to, during the sermon, I happened to turn to Jeremiah 3:15. And it says, and I will give you shepherds after my own heart who will lead you in knowledge and understanding. I read that, and it's like the Lord said, that's you. Huh. So when the invitation came, I went forward and surrendered to be a pastor. And then the Lord sent us back to, I went back to college, finished college, and went on to seminary and started pastoring.
Nice. That's pretty cool. I love to hear, I asked you that because there was a summer that I spent working with this ministry called Church Growth Development International. Mm-hmm. And my job was to call pastors all over the world and try to get all over America. And try to get them to let me come in, or my person come in, to sell them a fundraising program for their church. So I've talked to hundreds of pastors just by being that telemarketer person.
Yeah.
And I always, when I had time, I was able to ask, well, why did you become a pastor? How were you called to be a pastor, et cetera, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And almost 99% of the men that I talked to told me that they were never called.
Really?
Yeah, which I think is evident in a lot of the churches today.
Yeah.
I have people say things like, you know, I became a pastor because I wanted people to like me. I became a pastor because I wanted to be a leader and have lots of influence. I mean, seriously, that's what I've heard. So hearing your story is encouraging to me because I think that it's evident when somebody's called to be a shepherd. I mean, I'm blessed right now. I have a pastor that's a shepherd. Yeah. But there's a lot, as you know, are the hirelings and they're not there. You know, some of them call themselves life coaches. And that's not what a shepherd is. So,
Well, you know, it's been interesting to see how the Lord's answered that, you know, said, I will give you shepherds after my own heart will lead you in knowledge and understanding. And then the Lord then began to lead me in the direction of learning about young earth creationism and how to interpret scripture from that point of view. Mm-hmm. And so actually, I feel like the books that I've written are kind of a fulfillment of God's telling me what he was going to do with.
Yeah. Okay. So before I forget, what is your website? Because we'll probably put that up there on the bottom here.
Just well, it's www.operationtruthok.com.
So Operation Truth, okay, as in Oklahoma, right?
Right.com.
Yeah. Operation Truth. I like that. Hello, people. Go to OperationTruthOK.com. All right. So, and okay. So that's a very good segue, by the way.
Yeah.
All right. So here's the book, everybody. No Other Gods, a Biblical Creation Worldview. Okay. So let's talk about this because there are, like, you had Dr. Henry Morris endorse this, which was super cool.
You know, a lot of people may not know who he is.
I know. Go ahead. Tell people who he is.
Well, Dr. Henry Morris, he and John Wickham wrote a book back in 1962 called the Genesis Flood. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Morris was a professor at Rice University and a hydrologist, studied water. And so he wrote that. And that began actually the young earth creation movement that began to develop then that we see now, where you have Institute of Creation Research and Answers in Genesis and many other organizations now that are out there teaching the young earth point of view. And so I read that book. And then when I was in seminary, I got some of Dr. Morris's some of his videos, and then started just getting all of his books and just started reading his books. And so anyway, it was through all of that that I really became pretty well committed to the whole young earth interpretation of scripture. And but it all started with getting acquainted with Dr. Morris. And it was a really fantastic thing for me to have read his books. And actually, my book, No Other Gods, is a continuation of a book that he wrote called The Genesis Record. And I encourage people to get that, Genesis Record. And another book that he wrote was Scientific Creationism. Really great stuff. But anyway, so I wrote this manuscript back around 96, I guess it was, and I sent a copy to Dr. Morris to see if he would evaluate it, and he did. And he actually then wrote a foreword in it, and man, when you have your mentor, you know, your hero, be willing to write a confirmation of what you've written as being something that he felt like was actually going to have a positive impact. That really meant a big deal to me.
Yeah, I think it's great. Okay, and just because I know that we have some people probably who are like, well, you know, I have no idea what you're talking about when it comes to the whole young earth thing. So the way I understand this, you can correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm good at being corrected. You know, like, one of the things that drives me nuts is that You'll read a scientific article that talks about some archaeological discovery that happened 10 million years ago.
Yeah.
You know, they'll say something like, yeah, we found this from 15 million billion years ago. The galaxies are gazillion years old.
Yeah.
And I am a literalist. I believe God created the earth in 6 days. And on the seventh day, he rested. And but then, you know, there's people like who will say, well, you know, how old were Adam and Eve when they were born? Were they fully grown? Was the trees fully grown? Was everything created to look old, etc.? So explain what the young earth position is and kind of address some of that. And by the way, this is like basically a commentary on Genesis chapter 1 through chapter 11, right?
Right. Genesis 1:1 says, in the beginning, God created. Now, I just wrote a blog on this today, or a post on Facebook, where I had to ask the question, what comes first, your theology or your science? Well, that verse tells us that God created before there was anything. There was God. So God is pre-existent to this creation, to the universe.
Right.
Which means then that he's the creator. So we really need to have a proper understanding of who God is in order to have a proper understanding of who, of the creation that he created. And so as pastors, our theology needs to be the what causes us to develop our science. Which comes first, our theology or science? Our theology should determine what our science is rather than our science determining what our theology is. Right. And that's the big problem that we have, is a lot of pastors and professors and Christian schools and all this, all of they have ever been taught really was the old earth concept. There's the progressive creationist, you know, which is really a compromise trying to fit old earth ages into the Genesis record. Of course, what you have to do then is start reinterpreting all of that. And, but that's the wonderful thing about young earth theology. Basically, your theology determines your science, and you allow your theology and you allow your science. Then as you study your science is going to confirm your theology, you see.
Yes.
And that's what you see is that in the young earth, when you're the apologetics of young earth and all of that basically is showing the science and the archaeology and all those things that are actually confirm the fact that the earth is young, and that it does that with the science, and then it does that also with archaeology, which is a form of science and all that kind of thing. So that for me is I'm a theologian first, and then I'm a scientist, and my theology determines my science, and that's the way it was with Henry Morris how that he began to show how that science actually conforms to the theology, especially of Genesis chapter 1, and then continues to develop into the rest of the 11 chapters. And so anyway, and I'm finding that as people read my book and do a lot of the reading of, and all, there's all kinds of information out there about young earth theology. I mean, you can go to the Genesis Record Ark, you know, up there in close to Cincinnati. Man, you really get a whole lot of science supporting the theology there. But anyway, so that's basically my approach.
Okay, so why do you think then that people have a hard time believing that the creation, that Why do you think that so many people have a hard time believing that the world was literally created in 6 days? And we mean 24-hour days, right? We don't mean
24-hour days.
6,000-year periods. No, we don't mean that. We actually mean 6 24-hour days, right?
Yeah. Right. Well, I believe it's because they've been indoctrinated from the very beginning. When they go to school, they hear is monkey to man. The dinosaurs died out 70 million years ago. There's all kinds of they've made animated movies about the dinosaurs and the, you know, how it was way back when. So there's been a heavy form of indoctrination. And then too, there's been this elevation of science, right? that science is really the ultimate finder of truths and the way things are. And so people have really, that's all they've really been taught. It's really sad. Ken Ham wrote a book several years ago about Already Gone. And that's, he did a study of kids growing up in church, then going off to college. And then basically when they get out of college, or when they go to these classes and things that teach philosophy and science of an old earth, they come out 80%. He came out with 80% of those coming through out of church through college then no longer have their faith. And his explanation for that was, and is, that the children, young people go to church, and then they go to school, and then they learn something in school, and then they learn something in church. And a lot of times what they learn in church is, you know, Bible, believe this and all that. But when they have these questions about, okay, if the earth is only 6,000 years old, why do we have this radiometric dating and everything that tells us it's millions of years old? And they don't have Sunday school teachers, they don't have pastors, they don't have people that can say, wait a minute, that radiometric dating and all that is highly questionable.
Sure.
And that actually we do have things like the electric magnetic field that is actually depreciating at a certain rate, that if you go back more than 6,000 years, it would be too strong in order for life to exist on. You've got these different kinds of things that really answer those questions. But if the young people are not given those answers and those explanations, then they begin to think, well, maybe the Bible thing really, they don't really know what they're talking about, you know, and all of them, sometimes I don't. But, you know, I've been passing my book out, No Other Gods, in the prisons.
I was gonna ask you to bring that up, because that's
the
thing.
And
so he retired people, and now he goes into the prisons.
I go down to Lexington Prison, the assessment and reception place where these guys stay there for 23 hours a day, one hour a day they get out. So they've got plenty of time to read. So we give them Bibles, we give them my book to read. And I've got another book that I wrote, other books. But anyway, I'll tell these guys to start reading this book. And I had, I've gotten several cards, and I've had several tell me that all of a sudden they had all these questions that never got answered. And they read that book and they said, man, that answered all my questions. And had this one fellow, is probably close to 50, and he said he grew up in church and he had all this, and he just gave up on religion and all that kind of stuff. And he said, you know, I was reading your book here, and in a week's time, it answered all those questions I had. And he said, it's changed my life. And then he goes on to say, you know, I believe that God put me in prison just so I'd read that book. Just so that he could get his questions answered. Mm-hmm. The answers are there. But we get too busy and people just don't know. And of course, the school systems and the college systems and all are, most of them are so committed to the old earth, the evolution concepts and everything that they try to steer you away from that as much as they can.
But, yeah. I think there's nothing like when you're an author to have somebody read what you've written and go, oh, it changed my life, or I got a light bulb goes on and you're like, that was worth it. Because writing a book is not for the faint-hearted, you know. Writing a book is tough, and you've written, this is a pretty good sized book. I've written a little book compared to your book, but yeah, that's pretty cool. So I want to tell everybody a little bit about the book so you guys can get it, because I really want you to get this, because it's, I would not recommend a book. Most of you know that. I do not recommend books unless I look at them and I think they're good enough. Not that my testimony is, you know, the here end and be all, but this actually answered some of my questions. I was reading some of it last night. But so you start out every chapter, there's 15 chapters. With the question, which, and then there's words. So like, which God, which testimony, which beginning, which atmosphere, which environment, which cosmology, which life, which man, which account, which fall, which curse, which human history, which flood, which new world, and which dispersion. So there's not what I expected, by the way. You know what I was expecting? I'll tell you what I was expecting was to be able to open this up and go, all right, he's going to look at Genesis 1:1 and write a little commentary on it. And then he's going to do verse 2 and write a little commentary on it. That's what I was expecting. That's not what this is. This is a little bit different than that.
I was wanting the whole idea of which you have the secular understanding of, okay, how things began. You have the secular understanding about how they try to explain away the flood, you know, as a local flood or that kind of thing. And so what I wanted to do was give the opposite of whatever the world has been saying about how things were. Okay. That's why I came up with the witch thing,
which is very cool. Hmm. Which is very cool should be an addendum to the book. I'm kidding. Okay. Okay. All right. So this is, So I got some questions because I jumped to chapter 12.
Okay.
So which human history? And I just want to read some of this. I highlighted some of it. Okay. And then have you address it? Because I actually have gotten this question quite a bit about Adam, about Cain and Abel, Cain murdering Abel. But anyway, you wrote this. You wrote, man before the flood must have had a high level of technology because of what we have learned about very early societies that came into existence not long after the flood. Much of the foundations for that technology had to have been carried over by Noah and his family that quickly led to building cities of brick and mortar with towers and pyramids after the flood. So you talk about that. And then this is something I thought was kind of cool. And I did not know this. I would have never thought this, by the way. So I was reading this. I was like, oh, why did I ever think that? But anyway, so we have the story of Cain and Abel, right? And yeah. Everybody knows Cain killed Abel and they had to offer up these offerings, right? Mm-hmm. Right. I've heard in my Bible reading accountability groups that we were doing, obviously people start in Genesis, and I've heard the question numerous times from different people. Well, how come, you know, Cain's offering wasn't acceptable to God? And, you know, and I understand it now, but you actually explain it way better than even I understand it. But anyway, you actually wrote this too, and this is something new. So you wrote, Cain chose to live his life according to the curse of the ground, right? Abel chose to live his life according to the sacrifice by God to cover Adam and Eve's nakedness by raising sheep. A sheep was probably the animal God used to clothe Adam and Eve with, a point I've already made. You wrote that. And then fourth, parents can bring their children up to worship God, but each person is a free moral agent for better or worse, as we will see. Anyway, the thing that was kind of new to me was that, I mean, I always have heard that God covered, you know, he had to shed innocent blood to cover Adam and Eve. It never occurred to me what type of skin it was, because it doesn't say, but you're suggesting here it was a sheep, which would make actually complete sense to me. But anyway, can you want to talk about that a little bit? Because I thought that was kind of interesting, especially in light of some other stuff I've been looking at that you don't even
know. Yeah, well, when you really look at Cain's offering, Cain's offering is about his works. This is the work that he has done, and now he's going to give this. Whereas Abel's offering was basically, apparently, an offering of obedience. Now, something we have to understand is that as Adam and Eve basically went through what they went through, you know, having to see that animal that God sacrificed was probably an animal that they knew, you know, that and they probably had to watch that happen. You see, they'd never seen death. They'd never seen any of that. So they learned from that, obviously, that without the shedding of blood, there's no forgiveness of sin. And apparently they taught that to their children afterwards. Why do we know that? Well, because Cain brought an offering to God and Abel brought it. Where did they learn to do that? How did they know to bring an offering to God? Well, obviously their parents taught them.
Right.
But
which I never thought about before, to be honest. It never even occurred to me that was taught to them.
Yeah. Well, where did they learn it from? So right. The point is that, but you see where Cain, he's proud of what he's done. He's proud of what he's accomplished. And he wants to come and give some of that to God. Yes. And so God says, okay, Cain, you're bringing me this offering, but that's not what it's going to take for me to be able to forgive your sin. You see, it wasn't that God wasn't, you know, God wasn't rejecting Cain. He was rejecting his offering because the offering was not sufficient for God to bring forgiveness, for God to cover his sin. And so we see where, though, that God accepted Abel's offering because obviously Abel was following what he had learned from his parents, that God had to cover their nakedness, which is a symbol of their fallenness. And in order to do that, he had to shed blood. And so we see there that really Abel's offering is an offering of understanding and obedience. Cain's offering is more an offering of his pride and his work. You know, Paul says there that we're not saved by works, but by grace alone. And so you see that happening there, that Cain was really had been taught what to bring, but he brought what he thought he should bring.
You know,
and that's really sad. What we have nowadays is we have a lot of people that think, well, I'm a good person and I'm doing these good things and all that. Surely I'll get into heaven. You know, well, they don't. And so they think, I'm okay, you're okay, kind of a thing, and that's all that's required. Well, that story tells us, no, that's not all that's required.
Okay, so now I have a question, and this is maybe it just popped into my head. So, okay, so Abel was basically the first person to get into heaven.
Well, he was the first person to get into Sheol.
Okay. Into
paradise.
Paradise. Okay.
Everybody went to Sheol. There are two different parts of Sheol, the bad part and the good part. Abraham, you know, everybody like Samuel, when he comes up, mm-hmm. he doesn't go to heaven. They don't go to heaven until Jesus shed his blood. Then,
okay. That's what I was curious. Okay.
Yeah.
So Sheol is part paradise, part hell.
Right.
Okay. So Abel ended up in paradise.
Right.
It's like when Jesus said to the thief on the cross, today you'll be with me in paradise.
Right.
So it wasn't until after Jesus died that then he could be transferred into heaven.
Right.
Okay. I just thought of that. So it was just kind of an interesting thing because I never thought of that. But getting back to the point about Cain, you say in your book that that his sin was anger.
Well,
it was precipitated by anger.
Right? Well, that's what led to the murder. Yeah. Right. And but his sin that led to the murder, okay, was basically anger. You know, God says to him there, sin is knocking at the door, and you need to get it under control. But he doesn't. And so he murders his brother. But we see there then that basically his anger, though, was what? Hate for his brother that led to him being willing to come. And what do you have going on there, too? Jealousy. All these things are all working together that bring about Abel's death.
Yeah. Now, this is interesting, too. And I thought this was interesting when you wrote about this, too, because, okay, you'll probably be surprised about what I'm about to say, people, just so you know. But, okay, so it says here. So then you talk about sin and easily entangling us after that, right? Mm-hmm. You wrote, and I'm holding my book because I need new glasses. I'm in the in-between vision stage. Anyway, it says here, in this day and time, the gay and lesbian lifestyle is being justified by claiming that those who have adopted this lifestyle were born that way. The problem is that God's word says it is a sin because it violates God's original standard for one man to have one woman as a partner for life. It would be unjust for God to declare something a sin and then turn around and make someone that way in the womb. The problem is not that God made us to be a certain way. The problem is that we are fallen in sin, and homosexuality, like all other sin, can beset those who are vulnerable to that temptation or enticement. But God says that we must master those temptations before they take control of us. If you do not master sin, sin will master you. And then you wrote this. I highlighted this. It says here, homosexuality is a learned pattern of self-identification. As we develop from babies into adults, we are influenced by all kinds of stimuli that suggests positive or negative impressions of ourselves. Children are not sexually aware until they reach puberty or puberty, depending on if you're my husband. Anyway, normally, nowadays, because of all the bombardment of sex in our society, that's becoming less true. But normally, children naturally develop close bonds of friendship and love with those of the same sex until their attraction to the opposite sex begins to grow as they become teens. Some children may see this love for their same-sex friends as an indicator of being homosexual. And then you talk about that a little bit more. Why did you feel a need to bring that particular thing up in the midst of the whole Cain and Abel thing? I think it's cool you did, but I was a little bit surprised by that.
Well, because that's an issue that God's word there speaks to. And I felt like that the idea of someone being born that way, what people need to understand, what we all need to understand is, yes, we're all born that way. We're born with a fallen nature. Right. And I'm trying to make the point there that all of these different kinds of things that we get involved in are really an expression of our fallen nature. That's why every one of us need to understand that we are depraved and that we can't do anything to save ourselves. That's why Jesus had to do it for us. And so I just felt like that what we're dealing with homosexuality, basically, really that part of Scripture gave a good explanation or a foundation for explaining why that needs to be dealt with. And I'm hoping some people will read it and say, hey, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and, you know, traditionally, that's what people understand, you know, what you wrote. I mean, from just a developmental perspective, that's duh, you know, I mean, yeah. but, you know, it's interesting this morning. I was reading in John chapter 15, mm-hmm. And I was specifically zoning in on some of the verses that talk about, how Jesus said that he came to them and then they basically rejected him, even though he did works. And it talks about their sin, mm-hmm. that because he came to them, they rejected them. Because as a result, now, you know, they have to deal with their sin. The study I was looking at asked a question and they said, who was the day that they're talking about in John 15? And I thought, I didn't even think about it. So I read through it again and I was like, oh, the they is the religious leaders of the day.
Yeah.
And that got me going, thinking about how it's because I think we're in the day, like in the days of Noah, right? I think we're in the last of days for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
When you have apostate leaders in the church who are denying the Trinity and the fatherhood of God, which is tied into that John passage.
Yeah.
That, and this is something too, and I'm trying to make a point. So yesterday I decided I would go online and I would watch a sermon from an LGBT friendly church. Okay. Because I was curious. I was like, I wonder what they're talking about in these LGBT friendly church. Surely there's a church that's LGBT friendly and they're airing their sermons online. Well, I found one in Brea, California, where I used to live. And I thought, okay, I'm going to listen to it. At the end of this message, which a woman gave, it was a woman pastor. She ended her message by praying the Lord's Prayer. And she started the Lord's Prayer by saying, my creator who art in heaven, mm-hmm. hallowed be thy name.
Yeah.
And I had heard somebody actually say, oh, yeah, they're replacing the word father with creator because they don't want to acknowledge the fatherhood of God. Anyway, so that all that to say, that got me thinking about John, where this whole thing, Jesus is with the Father and the Spirit came and, you know, we got the Trinity and the whole idea of the Father, right? If they reject Jesus, they rejected the Father. Mm-hmm. Going back to Genesis, right?
Yeah.
You could say that Cain rejected his father's teaching, right? Mm-hmm. Adam's teaching. And there's a problem there because most men within prison, they don't have dads. All that. I know this is a whole new show. We're almost out of time. But anyway, all I have to say, I saw this connection between this reductionism of father and seeing God as father and the whole creation. If we remove fathers from the home and all that, it's actually all throughout Scripture, but just different than I thought.
Well, it's what we're seeing today, of course, with all of this woke stuff and everything going on, they're really trying to do away with the family.
Right.
And people and churches and everybody buying into it. But when you do away with the family, then everybody falls under the control of the powers that be. And of course, that's basically communism and that kind of stuff that's going on. And we've just seen it over time, a step by step moving in this direction, just like Hillary Clinton came out with her book, It Takes a Village. That's kind of a early steps into that way of thinking. And so when you do away with the family, you do away with individualism. And when you do away with individualism, you no longer are able to have the concept of individual rights. And you no longer exist as an individual person with value. You exist for the social order. And really that there's this changing of this mentality of the family, which was established back in Genesis chapter 2, and an ultimate and complete rebellion. It's totally satanic, really, when it comes down to it.
Oh yeah.
And when you finally want, when you're wanting to do away with the concept of the individual value of the individual person, and we're really seeing that now.
Yeah. All right. Well, you know what? This went way too fast. Like, our time is up practically. All right. So everybody, look, I know that you probably want this book, right? So where do you get it again?
Well, you can go to www.operationtruthok.com and you can order it there.
Yeah. And then you have
it's on Amazon.
Yes,
and
that's where I got
other
mine.
Place. Yeah, it's on Amazon.
Well, that's where they get it, though. They can order it. You can go to OperationTruthOK.com and then read all his blogs. And you have an email list that you do, or just no? Or
no, I just do the blog. I've just got started with all that. I'm just now on Facebook. I've only been on Facebook. And the only reason why I'm on Facebook is so I can tell people to go to my blog.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's very cool. Well, yeah. Do you have any final thoughts before my cat starts talking a lot and interrupting the interview? He's already talking a little bit.
No, I just appreciate the opportunity to get the word out that, hey, there are answers to your questions. And there's all kinds of places where you can go. Answers in Genesis, Institute of Creation Research, and many others. If you really want to know the truth, I encourage parents to make sure that your kids learn the young earth worldview. And I believe that it will help them to then, if you get the first 11 chapters of Genesis right, you'll get the rest of the Bible right. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
Is helping people. Well, I hate this day and time where they're saying, oh, the New Testament, we don't have the Old Testament, we don't need the Old Testament anymore. Well, that's the devil, because you don't understand what's going on in New Testament if you know what's been going on all the way up until that point in time, because God is bringing something to pass.
Yes.
From the old to the new.
I love the Old Testament, you know. Yeah. Was it Chuck Missler or somebody that said that the New Testament is concealed in the Old Testament and the Old Testament is revealed in the New Testament, which is amazing when you think about, we got 66 books that were written over a period of 1500 years or something like that.
Yeah. Well, if you have a young earth understanding, it was written over 4,000 years.
Okay. Over 4,000
years. From the time of the creation all the way to the time of Christ.
Yeah. It's crazy. The Bible is a miracle book, right? I mean,
it sure is.
And you were born way before you weren't. Wait.
1946.
Okay. So you were actually born 2 years before Israel was reestablished.
Yeah, that's true.
But the Bible talks about how Israel came into being in the first place, and then it left, and then it came back. So, yeah, there's some, I got an idea for you, but I won't say it on there. I'll say it after air. But anyway.
Okay.
Everybody, hey, Dr. Steve Kern, you heard him, and you'll want the book. Honestly, you should get it. And we're going to, if he says he'll come back, we're going to have him back, because there's other stuff I want to talk about.
Right. So
we will wrap this up, and we'll see you on our next show.
Thanks for having me.